It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The midterm elections are finally here, and people in Wisconsin and across the country are casting ballots for the candidates and causes they care about most. So what should you know before heading out to the polls? Well, that's what we're going to find out. As Reed Magny joins us, he represents the Wisconsin Elections Commission. That's the group responsible for administering and enforcing our state's election laws. Reed, welcome to the Morning Show.
Nice to be with you.
Let's start with the basics. What do you need to bring with you in order to vote?
If you're registered to vote, what you need to bring with you is an acceptable photo ID. Most people have what they need, and that includes a Wisconsin driver license, a Wisconsin state ID card, but we also accept things like a passport, a military ID, a veteran's ID. Many student IDs will work, although they have to be specially issued ones that have certain things on it that, like, a regular student ID doesn't have. You can also use tribal IDs and naturalization certificates. If you have a temporary receipt from the DMV because you don't have your card yet, that temporary receipt works as well.
What about an ID from another state, as long as you provide proof that you live in Wisconsin?
That doesn't work. You need. There's a list of IDs that you can use, and you can find that list at our website, which is bringit.wi.gov. But it has to be, for state IDs or driver's license, it has to be from Wisconsin. Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan, those won't work.
And if you haven't yet registered to vote, are you just out of luck today?
Not at all. Wisconsin has Election Day registration, and it has had for many years. We expect that more than 250,000 people will likely register to vote today, or more, based on historical trends. So in order to register to vote, you'll need your ID. And, I mean, if your ID has your current address on it, that's all you need to do to have to register. If you're like some people who've maybe moved a time or two since you got your driver license or ID, then you need to bring something called a proof of residence document. It could be a residential lease. It could be a utility bill, a cell phone bill, a bank statement, a student loan statement from the government, almost anything you have is written correspondence from the government. It could be a Social Security thing. It could be a pay stub that has your name and address on it.
Okay, a little hypothetical here. If a volunteer at a polling station says something that conflicts with this or any of the information you, Reed Magny, are giving us today, what can we do to ensure that we can vote?
So if you have a problem at the polling place, I would ask to speak with the chief inspector. The chief inspector at each polling place is the person in charge. And, if for some reason there's a disconnect, ask to talk to the chief inspector first. If you're still not getting satisfaction, you can contact the municipal clerk for that city, their office. They can straighten things out if there's a problem. Or you can just call us. We've got a toll-free number, which is 866-VOTE-WIS. Or 866-868-3947.
I just want to go back and clarify one thing about voting and registering to vote and what IDs will work. We said that an ID from another state doesn't work if you're voting. Can you use an ID from another state in order to register?
Well, an ID from another state wouldn't have your Wisconsin address on it, now would it?
No, but if you had, say, your utility bill, that would show your address. I just want to make sure
Right. People
understand what we're talking
right,
about.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, in order to get your ballot, you have to prove that you are who you say you are.
Right.
You do that by showing an acceptable photo ID from Wisconsin or the passport or the military ID or the veteran's ID, mm-hmm. the student ID, the tribal ID, etc.
Okay.
When you register to vote, you have to prove where you live. And you can do that with your ID if the address is correct. But if your address isn't correct on your ID, then you need some other sort of documentation.
Okay. When do polls open?
Polls are open at 7 a.m. and they close at 8 p.m.
And how can people find out where their polling place is?
We have a great website called My Vote Wisconsin. It's myvote.wi.gov, and you can go on there and you can put in your address, and it'll tell you where your polling place is. It's going to tell you what's on your ballot, so you can take a look and make sure that you know what your choices are before you get there. And it'll also, if you want, give you a map to help you get there.
Now, do you have to vote by 8 o'clock tonight, or do you have to be in line when the clock strikes 8?
You have to be in line by 8.
Okay. Now, some places have extra things on their ballot, like a local referendum, in addition to what, you know, the candidates were voting for. How can people learn what is on their ballot?
They should go to the myvote.wi.gov website. We'll have everything that's on your ballot right there. You can actually mark it yourself and print it out and bring it with you to the polling place if you want to refer to it. But all of the referendums are on there. You're going to have to do your own research about what some of the referendums mean, but all of the information is there that you'll see on your ballot.
We can at least find out what's on the ballot before we get to the polling place. We're talking with Reed Magny, who represents the Wisconsin Elections Commission. That's the group responsible for administering and enforcing our state's election laws. In light of all the talk about Russian hackers tapping into U.S. election systems in 2016, people are concerned about security. How secure are Wisconsin systems?
Wisconsin systems are very secure. You know, in 2016, two times somebody from a Russian IP address sort of rattled the door knob on the state's firewalls. If that, I don't know if that's too much of a mixed metaphor. I don't know if firewalls have doorknobs, but
they should.
Yeah. So, but I mean, they were just sort of looking to see what was there, seeing if there were any doors unlocked, and there weren't. And that's really been the extent to which anything has happened. And so since then, we have done a number of things to make sure that our system is even more secure. We've completely encrypted the database of Wisconsin voters. That's our main system that the clerks use to administer the election. We've also instituted something known as multi-factor authentication. So clerks need more than just a username and a password to get in. They need a third factor, and we've issued them all sort of a USB-type device that's secure that they have to have in order to get into the system as well. We've done a lot of training for clerks on how to make sure that the things they do keep the system safe. And we've done a lot of essentially dress rehearsals for what could go wrong. And we're sure that we're ready.
Where can people go to learn more before they go vote?
Well, I guess it depends upon what they want to learn. But if you want to learn specifically about where to vote and that sort of stuff, the My Vote Wisconsin website is your best choice.
Okay.
Our agency website, which is elections.wi.gov, has some really good information about election security. And
all right.
There's a lot of information there. But my understanding is that Wisconsin Public Radio and Public TV also have a good website.
Yes,
that will
we
tell
do.
You about the candidates themselves.
And we'll be giving that information in just a moment. Reed Magny represents the Wisconsin Elections Commission, the group that administers and enforces the state's election laws. Thank you so much for joining us. And tune in to WPR Tuesday night for live election coverage. NPR reports on national races starting at 7, and when polls in Wisconsin close at 8, Sean Johnson, Frederica Freiberg, and Rob Ferret anchor WPR's coverage of statewide elections, and that includes races for governor and senator. We'll be here throughout the night with election results and analysis. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Global warming threatens crops everywhere, including ones key to brewing beer, hops, and malting barley. Scientists and farmers are trying to figure out what making beer might look like in the future with hydroponics and even synthetic hops made from genetically engineered yeast. But it's also been projected that beer prices could double as farming becomes more difficult. We take a look at what beer brewing might look like in an age of warmer temperatures and more frequent droughts. Do you work for a brewery? Are you thinking about climate change and how it could affect your business? Do you plan on making any changes to make your work more sustainable or more adaptable to climate change? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the conversation. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Zoe Stricker is a freelance writer based in Argentina. Her article in the outline is called Can Beer Be Saved from Climate Change? Zoe, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you so much. Hi.
What are scientists predicting for the future of the crops used to make beer, like hops and malting barley?
Scientists are pretty frightened. Just all across the board, their predictions range for hops and malting barley. For example, with malting barley, scientists are predicting that the yield will decrease 3-17% globally. So it's a radically significant decrease. For hops, the numbers are a bit less clear, but basically hops production tends to fluctuate. So some years the production yields are really high, and then other years they're dropping off, and they expect there to be some fluctuation until it just sort of drops off, because there will be so much less snow melt.
Have we already seen the effects of climate change on these crops?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. 2014 in particular was a very erratic year. Some producers, I think, produced as much as 50% less than they had prior. And often what tends to happen with malting barley is it may still grow, but it sprouts too early to be made into malt. And that's a huge part of the problem.
Beyond beer, how have drought and other weather patterns caused by climate change affected agriculture on a global scale?
In unprecedented ways. We're seeing declines in virtually everything that's grown. I mean, predictions are being made. I mean, a lot of people are predicting that avocados will be virtually non-existent in a few years, given how much water they need to grow. Chocolate, coffee, lobster, crab, you name it, everything it's anticipated to either drop off or tastes of certain foods may change quite a bit given how they'll need to be grown or what the climate conditions will look like. That's especially clear with wine. Grapes are changing in taste and areas where they actually grow in a way that is what we're used to.
Getting back to beer for just a moment, the Yakima Valley in Washington grows about 3/4 of all the hops in the United States. Mm-hmm. This region that's so critical to beer production had to deal with the pressures of climate change?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the issue is that the U.S., in Germany, there are more hops. They have a greater environment, you could say, for hops production. Like, there's plenty of space where hops could grow, but the U.S. is the greatest producer of hops in the world, and so 75% of hops produced from the U.S. are out of this region, and so they've seen really insane fluctuations in their production because they really can't predict the weather. So some years it'll be fine, normal, and then other years they couldn't even have anticipated it necessarily.
What are the growing conditions that hops need, and how have the farmers in the Yakima Valley responded to these changes?
Hops tend to need As far as I understand, they need places like Washington State, so that are very damp, in theory, like in a forest-like, and that get a lot of snow melt. That's most critical. The snow melt is really crucial for the hops to grow, and so. The farmers in that area have been very deeply concerned because they, you know, the hops that are produced there are so good because of the natural factors that flavor it. So moving those crops indoors or anything like that is theoretically an option for those businesses, but the taste will arguably change. And so farmers are concerned.
What can they do? I mean, other than growing their crops using different methods, which would change the taste, they really don't have a lot of options then, do they?
Doesn't seem like it, no. I mean, they could adapt. They could go indoors
We're talking with Zoe Stricker, freelance writer based in Argentina, about how climate change may affect the cost of your next brew. And we're talking about beer prices possibly doubling in the near term because the crops that are most used and most necessary for brewing beer are under a lot of pressure from our changing climate. We want to know, okay, so what do you think about this? Maybe you are somebody who really enjoys different kinds of beer and you have some concerns or questions. Call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Maybe you're somebody who brews beer and you have some concerns about this. Maybe some ideas of what might be done to compensate for how the climate is changing the way the crops are grown. 800-642-1234. Give us a call and join the program. What other steps have barley and hops farmers taken, Zoe, to adapt to changing weather patterns and prepare for a future with higher temperatures and more frequent drought?
That, in many ways, remains to be seen. Some breweries are, for the first time, this is probably what I found most interesting in conducting this research. Some breweries are offering farmers bonuses if they disclose their sustainability practices. So because they can show to the consumer, it's become marketable for them to produce their product, to say, look, you know, these farmers use these X, Y, and Z sustainable methods. However, those methods, a lot of farmers don't necessarily talk about them, and it's actually hard to know how people are changing their growing patterns or practices. What's most seen at this point is what academics are doing in moving these crops inside, or, you know, synthetically creating them. But as far as farming goes, it's pretty unknown. It's more or less unknown.
Is it true that scientists have figured out how to make beers taste hoppy without actually using hops?
Yep, that is true. That is that was created out of UC Berkeley. Two microbiologists used a gene. A gene cutting tool and a gene replication tool. So I think it was using basil and the genes of basil and mint and one other thing, created a flavor to insert into yeast that tastes virtually the same. And so they've completely eliminated the need to add hops to beer and are now, these two scientists are creating their own brewery. And they've taste tested with Lagunitas beers and things like that. And they figured it out.
Let's get a quick caller in here before we break for news. Noah is in Rice Lake. Noah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a brewery owner. We're in the middle of construction here in Rice Lake. And more we're able to access local ingredients from Sorona, 20 miles away, Deer Lake Farms over in St. Croix, 40 miles away, and more smaller breweries are being able to have access to this. So with the changing climate, if those sources go away, it makes it much, much more difficult.
Okay, Noah, thank you. Noah, a brewer from Rice Lake, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. already feeling the effects, but so far able to source locally. Zoe, we're going mm-hmm. to take a break here, but our conversation with you will continue in just a moment. Zoe Stricker, a freelance writer based in Argentina. Her article in The Outline is called "Can Beer Be Saved from Climate Change?" And that's what we're wondering. That's the big question. Can we save the beer? Can we save the avocados? Lots of stuff to save. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor recently announced she's been diagnosed with dementia and probably Alzheimer's, a disease that affects an estimated 5.7 million Americans. We're joined by a doctor to talk about the disease, its risk factors and treatment options, and how it affects people both emotionally and physically. Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with Alzheimer's? What was it like to find that out? Were your doctors clear or vague about what this diagnosis meant for the quality of life you would lead going forward? What's your biggest frustration with the way Alzheimer's is understood and treated? Maybe you care for someone with Alzheimer's. What's that story like? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Dr. Nate Chin is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Medicine. He is also the director of medical services at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Dr. Chin, welcome to the Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
Before we jump right into it, I want to first make sure that we understand this. What is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
That's one of the most important questions someone can ask, because there is a difference. Dementia is an umbrella term used to describe a group of symptoms that someone may feel or that others may observe. Alzheimer's disease is the actual disease itself that can cause dementia. It's the most common cause, but Alzheimer's can cause another syndrome called mild cognitive impairment, which is different than dementia.
And there are a lot of, well, I don't know about a lot, but there are a number of conditions, medical conditions, particularly in our elderly population, that can result in dementia. Even something like a bladder infection or things like that can produce dementia.
So there are a number of medical conditions that can cause confusion and that can cause changes in thinking. But as far as dementia itself, dementia is a progressive condition of one where a person's declining in their cognition as well as their function. And so those really are reserved for conditions that are in the brain itself.
Okay. Just wanted to be clear about that. What are the signs that someone may have Alzheimer's?
So the Alzheimer's Association has a really nice website for describing the 10 most common symptoms. But I can tell you in my clinic, short-term memory loss is the most common complaint that someone will report. So whether that's forgetting their things at a grocery store or why they walked into a room. Other complaints are with word finding, completing sentences, even people who just feel like they're more distracted or they're lacking the attention they used to have. Those are common complaints.
If someone notices that they or someone they know is exhibiting these signs, what should they do?
Well, I would say the first thing is to find someone you trust and that knows you and ask them if they've observed any changes. It's a hard thing to do because people are pretty apprehensive about talking about memory change. But if someone else has observed it, then that does seem to validate a person's concerns. And regardless, I think going to your primary care provider to share your concerns and start really a cascade of an evaluation.
And is there a test for Alzheimer's disease?
So there's no definitive test. The only way a person will know if they have Alzheimer's is through a brain autopsy, and so that's not really helpful to the living person.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that through a really good clinical history from both the person and someone they know and trust, as well as cognitive testing or brain testing, that is one of the most helpful ways for us to determine, are your complaints normal aging or is there something else going on?
What sorts of research work is being done to maybe create a test for Alzheimer's?
Well, so there's this concept of biomarkers, which are really surrogate ways of seeing about Alzheimer's disease in the brain. So like I said, with autopsies, the most definitive, and now we're looking at ways to replace or mimic an autopsy, looking for the actual pathology in the brain. And so that would look at, those are scans, so PET scans or lumbar punctures, looking at the fluid that actually bathes the brain. And a newer concept is blood-based biomarkers, where we can simply draw a blood sample and with a collection of these proteins determine if someone is at higher risk or could be having those changes already.
Dr. Nate Chin is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Medicine. He is also the director of medical services at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Were you or a loved one diagnosed with Alzheimer's? What was it like to find that out? Were your doctors clear or vague about what this diagnosis meant for the quality of life you would lead going forward? Share your Alzheimer's story or ask Dr. Chin a question about Alzheimer's by calling us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. There are a lot of unknowns when it comes to Alzheimer's. Do we have any ideas about what causes it?
Yes, through decades of research, we know that a protein, an abnormal protein in the brain called amyloid, is the beginning part of it. Amyloid causes inflammation and it disrupts our brain cells, and that leads to another protein called tau. So amyloid and tau are present, and that leads to cells, our brain cells, dying. And when our brain cells are dying, they're not communicating. And that's when the symptoms develop, and that's when people notice.
And how do we die? I mean, you said earlier the only way to definitively prove that someone has had Alzheimer's is through pathology, an autopsy, which obviously is going to happen after we're dead. But what are the tools that we use? How do we diagnose Alzheimer's without that?
Well, so a memory clinic, which there are many across the state of Wisconsin, it's a very long clinic, about 2 to 3 hours in duration. And that's because we are collecting just a clinical history, a report from the person who's having symptoms, as well as from family members or those that they trust who provide their observations. We also do 45 minutes to an hour long of brain testing, which is a pretty rigorous test, looking at the many different parts of our brain and seeing if those changes that they're observing are normal, because our brain does change as we get older, or if there's actual impairment, there's an actual deficit. We also have to rule out treatable causes like depression, medications, sleep apnea. And when all of those things have been addressed through blood tests, through head imaging, we use our best clinical judgment to provide the diagnosis.
How important is it to detect this disease at an early stage?
I think it's critical. Our research is showing that the best opportunity for intervention is going to be as early as possible. And so people coming in and having the courage to go through this hour-long brain testing is very helpful in determining, well, what can we do, or what is there, and then what can we do?
And what are the risk factors associated with Alzheimer's?
So it's vascular and metabolic. And so what that means is high blood pressure has been strongly associated, obesity, diabetes, smoking, depression, even genetic risk factors. But that doesn't mean that you're going to get the disease. It just means you're at higher risk for the disease.
Is this a preventable disease?
We're hoping to move in that direction. There's this concept of cognitive reserve, or as I like to say to my patients, building a brain buffer. And as we get older, we're experiencing many insults to our body, many insults to our brain. And if we can build a bigger buffer, perhaps we're not stopping the disease itself, but we're allowing our bodies to handle all of those changes.
What do you mean by a brain buffer?
So if we know that through people having higher education, that is a protective factor. We know that people who are physically active can actually handle more of that amyloid protein than people who are not physically active. And so it's this concept of, even though we're not specifically addressing the amyloid and the tau, our brains are capable of handling the presence of those better than people who are not doing certain activities.
And what about doing things like crossword puzzles and word find and Sudoku or other mind games that people have been encouraged to play? Are those helpful as well?
So I encourage my patients to do those as well, and I call that cognitive enrichment. So it may not be formalized education, but think of the brain as a muscle. You use it or you lose it. And this idea that people are training their brain or just really keeping it active is important. So learning new things, taking on new hobbies, playing brain games, it will be helpful potentially in that area that you're training, but it isn't going to overflow into something else like memory.
Mm-hmm. So maybe hosting talk shows is good for my brain. How is Alzheimer's treated?
Well, so there are medications that are used to treat symptoms. And I always explain to people the hope is that we can keep you stable or slow the rate of decline. But it isn't really addressing the underlying pathology of this amyloid, this tau protein. In addition to that, compensatory strategies, so people using sticky notes, whiteboards, providing routine and structure, I think are critical. And then lastly, these lifestyle modifications that we're looking at from our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, people being physically active, diet, sleep.
What's the prognosis for someone who has Alzheimer's? And I realize that's a really broad question.
Well, no, I think it's an important one. So dementia and Alzheimer's disease, these are terminal conditions. The life expectancy on average is 7 to 10 years, although we see people pass away earlier within 1 year or even later into 20 years.
Dr. Nate Chin is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Medicine. He is the also the Director of Medical Services at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Our conversation continues in just a moment. Are you a caregiver for someone who is living with Alzheimer's? What is their experience like? What is it like for your family? Do you take part in a memory clinic? And what is that like? We'd like to hear your stories of Alzheimer's. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We'd like to hear your story of Alzheimer's and how your family is dealing with it, how you deal with it yourself. Maybe you're somebody who is in an early stage of Alzheimer's. What was it like when you got the diagnosis? Maybe you have a question for Dr. Chin. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email is ideas@wpr.org. And you can also reach us on Twitter. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor recently announced she's been diagnosed with dementia and probably Alzheimer's, a disease that afflicts an estimated 5.7 million Americans. Dr. Nate Chin, Director of Medical Services at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, is with us to talk about the disease, its risk factors and treatment options, and how it affects people both emotionally and physically. Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with Alzheimer's? What was it like to find that out? Do you care for someone with Alzheimer's? Tell us that story. What kind of emotional toll has this diagnosis had on you or your family? What should other people know about Alzheimer's as they prepare to care for a loved one with this disease? 800-642-1234, ideas@wpr.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Three ways to get in touch this morning. Marlene has reached out to us by phone. Marlene, good morning. Welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning. A number of weeks ago, I heard a radio broadcast on the Wisconsin Public Radio with a doctor from MIT, and they were doing research on Alzheimer's and dementia, and they were using pulse light, I'm not sure what wavelengths or whatever, and exposing through the eyes the brains of test animals with this light. And these animals showed a reduction in the amyloid proteins and also an improvement in their ability to retain memories of short-term, like improve their short-term memory. They would expose them to scary situations, as they put it, in a different environment than their normal cage. And those that had been exposed to the light, when put back into that environment, showed the appropriate fear response, whereas the other animals who didn't have the exposure to the light acted like they'd never been there before because they couldn't remember, or at least that's what they assumed. I wonder if the doctor is aware of those studies, and I realize they were on animals at the time, but they were looking to do human studies, clinical studies.
So Marlene, it's an excellent question, and I'm not familiar specifically with that MIT study, but there have been lots of prior studies looking at light waves through the eyes to see how that affects that protein, amyloid. And I think what it speaks to is the importance of the fact that we don't yet know exactly why amyloid is building up in some people. We all make amyloid protein. And frankly, for some people who develop the disease, it's because we're not clearing it appropriately. And for others, it's because they're making too much of it and we simply can't clear enough of it. And so these studies are really important in looking at how are these proteins forming and why are they forming. So I can't answer specifically what they're showing. But as you said, these are very important. And frankly, it starts with animals and then it moves on to humans. So that's the usual process.
We've talked a lot about the scientific aspect of Alzheimer's, but what kind of emotional toll can it take on those living with this disease?
It's a difficult disease. And so family members often see their loved one change in ways that they were not anticipating. And so I would say that it's an emotional roller coaster because they're still the person you love. They're just a different version. And so for a lot of people, each stage brings a different challenge or different challenges. And frankly, if they're prepared for those, I think they can find more meaning in this entire journey with the person with dementia.
I want to play a clip from the radio show This American Life. This episode follows a wife and a husband who have found a good way to interact with the wife's mother, Virginia, who has Alzheimer's. The couple uses improv, which is where someone says something, and no matter what, everyone else has to accept that and play along. In this clip, Virginia, who again has Alzheimer's, points to the dog, Gus, who is digging. Her son-in-law plays along.
He's digging, like, for his life.
Gus is busy working on his caverns. He's starting a coal mine, so he's going to get it started, and you're going to finish it up, right?
I am.
The coal mine.
The coal mine. I never worked in a coal mine.
I know.
Dr. Chin, what can we learn from this approach?
Well, the approach is called validation therapy. And what we're finding and what I recommend to patients' families is really meet the person where they are. Later in the disease, a person may have misconceptions about what they see or really be talking about things that are not fitting to the conversation. And instead of our usual behavior of correcting someone or directly asking, you know, why are you saying these things, instead we find that people who meet them where they are and really go down the rabbit hole with them and enjoy whatever the person is saying and asking questions about that, why do you see that, what do you think the dog is doing, we find that those interactions are more pleasing to the person with the memory change as well as to the family member.
And sometimes I know some of these memory changes can produce something that I have experienced with a loved one called looping, where someone will say something and then about 2 minutes later they'll repeat the same thing. And when this first started, it just kind of startled me, and I didn't know how to respond. But eventually, every time it happened, I said, yeah, that's really interesting, and change the subject. And, you know, well, Mom, you just said that 2 minutes ago. Well, no, you know, no kidding, really. So she said that to you. Huh, interesting. Say, what are we having for dinner tomorrow? You know, that kind of thing. And that's kind of what you're talking about here then.
Absolutely. So instead of correcting someone, living that experience with them and then redirecting them, it is a perfectly healthy way of doing it. And it can be aggravating for both people involved. And so really to diffuse that situation, exactly what you just said is very helpful.
How should we not interact with people who have Alzheimer's?
Well, I would say this idea of correcting them, this idea of interrogating them, trying to force rationality and our views onto them. We do not want to be antagonistic. We need to understand that the person in front of us has a disease in the brain, and the things that we're seeing that may be upsetting to us, it's not because they're doing it to upset us. It's a part of the disease itself, and to be more accepting of that, and as you've said, redirect them. Go down a different path.
We had a call from Dan in Milwaukee who couldn't stay with us, but he says he saw his father die from Alzheimer's and it was awful. He thinks you should have the option to go out gently on your own terms if you have Alzheimer's, and it should be a right, but it's illegal.
That, you know, there are, I've experienced many people who've had various spectrums of opinions on that. It is not an easy disease, and many people do die in an unfortunate situation, and I would say that by preparing for it in advance, we can honor our loved one's wishes by having them live and die the way that they wish to do so.
What resources are out there for people who want to have a better understanding of how to care for those with Alzheimer's?
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin system, we have a website for memory loss, for people who have questions about memory loss. The National Institute on Aging has a very nice website. And then the Alzheimer's Association has a great website of both information as well as caregiver support information.
And once a loved one is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, what should their family or friends start considering as far as long-term care?
Well, one, I would say health care powers of attorney. Everyone needs one, no matter how old you are. We want to make sure that the people who they trust are making decisions for them later on in the disease. Financial powers of attorney, advanced directives, advanced care planning, talking about what is meaningful to you. How do you live your best day? How do you want your disease to affect you? How do you want to die, as the previous caller just specified? Being able to address those things, as well as, well, what is most meaningful to you, and how do we best achieve that?
We know there's no cure for Alzheimer's yet, but how far has research into the disease progressed since it was discovered in the early 1900s?
We have not succeeded in our clinical drug trials, but we do have a much better understanding of the pathology itself. And it starts with that. Understanding the triggers, understanding how the disease course goes will be helpful in figuring out, well, where is the best intervention.
Dr. Nate Chin is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Medicine. He is also the director of medical services at the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Dr. Chin, thank you for coming in and talking with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a reminder that tonight, tune in at 7 for live election coverage from NPR and WPR. We'll be here throughout the night with live updates of election returns and analysis of national and state races. You can follow the results at wisconsinvote.org. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.